Right on. Well, thanks again. Looking forward to having you back on and following up. Folks, you've been listening to Prison Pipeline, airing from the studios of KBOO Portland. Listen to this and previous Prison Pipeline programs at kboo.fm/prisonpipeline. Like Prison Pipeline on Facebook. Special thanks to our amazing guest and a Prison Pipeline Collective member, Karen James, for post-production. Free them all.
Free them all, bro.
They won't build no schools anymore. All they build will be prison, prison. They won't build no schools anymore. All they build will be prison, prison. They won't build no schools anymore. All they build will be prison, prison. Cause today, yeah, I am a prisoner. I am a prisoner. I'm a prisoner.
KBOO Portland on 90.7 FM and streaming on the web at kboo.fm.
Hello, dear listeners. Oil for Kisses is a monthly program on KBOO 90.7 FM Portland that highlights the headier and weirder sides of underground metal, post-punk, DIY hardcore, and beyond. Every month features a different theme where we delve into the history of a specific genre topic or musical location, or simply churn out the best, brightest, and ugliest sounds from around the globe. Join me, DJ Krauthammer, every first Friday night, Saturday morning of the month, at midnight till 3 a.m. for Oil for Kisses to experience it for yourself, only on KBOO 90.7 FM Portland.
Sit. A chump can sit. A coward can sit. Anything can sit. Well, you and I have been sitting long enough, and it's time today for us to start doing some standing and some fighting back that up.
Hard knock. Hard knock radio. Hard knock radio. Hard knock radio.
Davey D, Hard Knock Radio, hanging out with you this afternoon. Sitting in front of me is former mayor of Berkeley, a longtime freedom fighter. His name is Gus Newport. He's no stranger to our airwaves, and for people who know his tenure, he's somebody who's been on the front lines doing a lot of things to improve the conditions of our people and of the lives of folks who like to align themselves with humanity. We're talking with Gus because I want to do a series on history, and I wanted to pick the brains of those who have been on the front lines, unearth some stories and some insight, so we can always have that in our collective memories. And for many people that are listening, they may not know that Gus Newport was good friends with Malcolm X, El Haj Malik Shabazz. He was part of helping organize and get together Malcolm's organization, the OAAU, the Organization of African American Unity. And so, Gus, we appreciate you taking time out this afternoon to join us. When we talk about Malcolm X, We know him for his work in the Nation of Islam. We know his work as somebody who was a street cat, Detroit Red, and all that he's gone through. But he's also somebody who comes from a family that has a rich lineage in freedom fighting, going all the way back to Marcus Garvey. Can we talk a little bit about that, the importance of Marcus Garvey, Malcolm's father being a Garveyite, and how we see some of that philosophy that comes out of Marcus Garvey in the work that Malcolm would eventually do?
Well, Malcolm's father was a Garveyite, but he was also a minister, and he was hounded constantly by white extremists, etc., and whatever else. And the kinds of abuse he received played a real bad impact on Malcolm's mother, who ended up with real psychological problems, etc., and whatever else. So, and even one of Malcolm's brothers was killed also. So, you know,
I didn't realize his brother was killed? One of his brothers?
One of his brothers. So it just had a horrific force on, you know, what white extremists would do and got away with. Again, like I say, you know, the powers to be did not want to make this stuff well known, so the media only reports what wanted. If you notice right now to this day, everything bad, drugs, crime, whatever happens in the black community is constantly reported. That which happens in predominantly white communities is never reported. And so I think going back to Malcolm's father and the Garveyites, they had seen through that even though this country was supposedly founded as the primary democracy in the world, the land of the free and the home of the brave, that the white man being what it was generally, they could not see any changes. So it had to be done amongst ourselves.
We're talking with Gus Newport. You know, let's talk a little bit about Malcolm. When did you first meet him? And, you know, what stands out to you about him that many people may not know?
I met Malcolm in 1961. I was drafted in the military in 58. I got let out early because I asked too many questions in 60. Civil rights movement was in great stride. Rochester was one of two cities that had two race riots. Because of my activism, my mother's, they ended up putting me in charge of a police brutality case that was the first one won in a federal court in the United States. The police, after what they brutally beat his brother, who was a gas station attendant, 2 weeks later, they raided the black Muslim mosque. Daisy Bates, history remember, responsible for having Eisenhower bring his troops in to integrate the schools in Little Rock, Arkansas, was in Rochester organizing for the NAACP. And, of course, Malcolm and all of them, they all knew each other. Malcolm called her and said, "Daisy, I'm going to be coming to Rochester. Who should I be in touch with?" She gave him my phone number, whatever. Didn't even tell me. I get a call one night, it's Malcolm X. We talked for 2 hours.
So he was already known. What was that like? I mean, how did you feel to get a phone call from Malcolm X?
I can't tell you, man. I was so taken. It was a beautiful feeling, but you don't know what to say or what not to say. You don't want to show your ignorance, you know. Right. That? So I listened and I listened. But Malcolm knew how to take it. Tell me what life is like in Rochester. How are blacks treated? What were the schools like? What are jobs like? And what he's doing is making you recognize more and more we live in an unreal system, you know, that we hadn't even recognized because you come to accept life as it is. So this goes by for 2 weeks, and Malcolm flies into Rochester on a cold February day. Rochester, New York is cold, brother. It's right across from Canada. And in those days, planes landed on the tarmac, and they let the stairs down. And I was standing inside the airport waiting with a couple of brothers from the Nation. But we were surrounded by all these white men in white shirts and overcoats and felt hats. And so Malcolm comes through the door, and he says, "We hadn't seen each other. Who is Gus Newport?" I said, "I am, sir." He said, "Young blood, you got the best tap telephone in America. This is all FBI here." So, you know, he gave a speech. The press was there, you know, and everything. We got in our cars and left. Went back to the jail where the police had arrested some brothers. And the brothers wouldn't eat nothing but drink milk because they didn't trust might be some pork in that food and whatever else. And we fed them. Malcolm talked to them. Malcolm and I went up to see the sheriff. The next day, the sheriff was a big old fat white guy, weighed about 500 pounds. And, you know, a lot of the Muslim belonged to the Eastern Star, whatever it is. Malcolm had his ring with the star on it and this and that. and so did this white sheriff, and they compared notes. And
that's like the Mason thing, right, or something like that.
Right. So Malcolm got him to, he got him to talk. So we go right from there over to the courthouse where they're going to start the trial. And Malcolm and I are sitting on one side of the room, and the sheriff on the other side. And to show you, in all this seriousness, how Malcolm had a sense of humor, the sheriff sort of fell asleep. So Malcolm leans over, whispers, he said, "Brother, turn your head slowly. But the power of Allah just snatched that cracker's heart." He didn't have a heart attack. He was falling asleep. But he woke up a few minutes later, and Malcolm said, "Oh, Allah gave him a break, brother." But we got one thing, got the brothers out, and we took them to a place, fed them warm milk and soup and stuff.
Right.
Brought them back. And Malcolm stayed there for a couple of days, came back the next day and spoke at a nonprofit center. And within 24 hours, the state legislature in New York passed a law that Malcolm X could not speak in any government-funded organization or nonprofit organization. From that day on, he was invited to speak in churches or at the Divinity School or places like that. In 24 hours, they passed that legislation.
So they were trying to make the whole thing of separation of church and state and enforce that?
Right. And they passed the law without even discussion. I don't think a piece of legislation has been passed ever that quickly before or since in the history of this country.
You know, with Malcolm, well, you talked about in 1961, so he's still with the Nation of Islam,
right,
you know.
Right.
What was it like when he was going through his separation from the Nation? How close were you all, and were you in contact with him, and did he share with you any of his concerns about what was going on?
Well, I soon after Malcolm came to Rochester, and because of my activities, I couldn't get any work. So I ended up moving to New York. Went to work
New York City.
Right. I went to work for IBM because I'd gotten that kind of training in the military. And I worked also for HARUAC, which is a community action agency. At HARUAC, I worked also with Bumpy Johnson and Teddy Butler, with the five percenters.
Bumpy Johnson, the gangster Bumpy?
Yes, sir.
You worked for him?
Bumpy,
see,
when he got
you knew Bumpy? Wow.
When Bumpy got out of prison, he came to work for HARUAC. As a matter of fact, by that time, Juanita Portier and Sydney were separated, and Bumpy went with Juanita. And Bumpy took a lot of kids with Juanita up to the Adirondacks in the summer, exposed them to swimming and boating and stuff like that.
What was that like? Because Bumpy seemed like, you know, for many people, like a hero, because at a time when you have the mafia and organized crime and Lucky Luciano and all that, Bumpy Knuckles or Bumpy Johnson seemed like somebody who was able to stand up to them.
Well, it was really interesting because, you know, Bumpy did time for murder. When he came out, he put together an insecticide company, you know, stuff. But he worked with HARUAC, and Teddy Butler was, I forget the name of the restaurant, Red Rooster. Mm. He was, the manager, you know, most for Red Rooster. But he had sort of come up through Hard Knocks himself. And when Dutch Schultz was trying to bring drugs, can you stop it a minute?
Sure. Been talking with Gus Newport, was asking you about Bumpy Johnson and what that was like in terms of, you know, working with him, because he seemed like such a folkloric hero to people. And you're saying that he started his own insecticide company.
Yeah, his own insecticide, but he was working with HARUAC and with this young group of guys called the Five Percenters. And they asked me to participate with it. Now, a very interesting thing happened because Bumpy recognized the troubles he went through, but he and Teddy Butler also became the go-between when Dutch Schultz and them tried to bring drugs up into Harlem. And these brothers stood up to him, and they respect him. But what happened one night, Teddy Butler owned the Truth Coffee Shop up on 137th, and he and Bumpy were quite close. And Baraka comes in one night. This is after
Amiri Baraka.
Amiri. He was running the
Black House?
The theater.
Right.
The theater up there. And so this was after he had done the Dutchman and had fallen on bad times with his white wife. So he walks into Teddy Butler's restaurant one night, and he sees these white waitresses, and Teddy's not around, and he leaves a message with his boys. "You let Teddy know these white girls better not be working up here 24 hours from now, or it's hell going to break up. So when Teddy comes back, he gets it, and he calls Bumpy. And Bumpy comes up from downtown. And he said, no, that punk didn't say that.
Meaning to Mary.
Yeah. So what they did, Bumpy told me, he said, now you go over to the theater, and you tell Mary if a dish falls off the shelf at this restaurant, his black ass is dead.
Wow.
And Mary moved to Newark in 24 hours. But I was scared to death because I had to go and deliver the message. And this theater had the walls were all painted black. They had brothers with little short loincloths on with straight bows. I mean, the days were something. There was a lot of stuff going on, man. And so I'm learning all this stuff and scared to death. But, you know, I'm in the movement. And I love it, you know.
How did Malcolm navigate? Did he know Bumpy? Well, obviously he knew Mary, but what were those relationships like? Or what did you understand those relationships to be like?
Everybody respected what Malcolm was doing with young brothers, disciplining them, giving them respect, working, taking care of families and this and that. And that is something that everybody aspired to. And Malcolm was so warm and talked with everybody. See, Malcolm did not look down on anybody. Malcolm was just one of the warmest brothers, you know, this and that. So, and he didn't drink, but he come sit down the joint and talk with you, as Adam Clayton Powell, who was his closest friend. And as you said, and he loved jazz, and Max Roach and them were playing uptown these joints, you know, Miles and all this and that. And these brothers really believed in movement stuff, you know, and this and that. And, you know, it's, I'm glad you're bringing this up because I had forgotten about those times gone by, what it really was like. The cluster, you know, the family unity to raise a better society for our own good, you know. And it's, and all that starts, you're right, with Marcus Garvey and coming right on up through the ranks. Franz Fanon, I mean, we were, as teenagers, when I first came as a very young guy, you know, every place I go to, I forget the bookstore that was in Harlem. If I called his name, you'd remember. But, you know, Franz Fanon, we'd be just sitting down talking. You'd think that we were, you know, some kind of academic, you know, things. But the other thing is, when things were getting bad and the white cops was acting up, we had science books that showed us how to make Molotov cocktails, too. So it was just a whole lot of things going on that I haven't given thought to in a long time.
You know, with Malcolm and his split from the Nation, you know, we talked about, you know, just when we were talking earlier about the type of concern he had with the contradictions around, you know, the death of Kennedy, and then learning that the Nation had met with the Klan or Elijah. What was that about?
JFK pulled together a meeting between Elijah Muhammad and the head of the Ku Klux Klan, because they were both nationalist organizations looking for separate parts of the country where they could just live by themselves. And he pulled them together to exchange information so that they could pursue working toward this.
Malcolm, really? So he felt like, you know, maybe it's better just to separate and have your own space.
What do you mean, JFK?
Yeah.
Well, that's politically what he was playing. You know, I mean, you know, let's face it, his daddy had controlled the Scotch market coming from Ireland, because I used to work in the Virgin Islands and those kind of open markets. So when Malcolm found this out, he recognized, he said, well, yeah, we might be nationalists looking for a separate state, which was one of Elijah Muhammad's ideas, but not to be involved in no kind of relationship with the Ku Klux Klan, who were all about devastation and lynchings, etc. Everything. So when JFK got killed, and Malcolm had just become aware of that because John Ali and some of them had exposed it to the higher echelon, though some of them were reporting to the FBI then too, Malcolm just went on radio meeting and said, chicken's coming home to roost. And that was saying, well, JFK is playing games and something like this. Look what happened to him.
Wow, so that's the deepest story behind that remark, you
yes.
know? And people did, and people should remember, you know, the Klan bombing cities. I mean, at this time, Birmingham, Alabama, known as Bombingham, because not just for the four little girls, but they were routinely bombing black neighborhoods,
right.
Lynching people all over the place. And so they were, you know, today people may see them as clownish, but back then they were a serious force.
They thought they had the right and the justification to do that. And the courts weren't doing anything about it.
Right. So hearing this, he sees that this is not the move, and on top of Elijah Muhammad's transgressions as well.
Elijah Muhammad just chose to make that because Malcolm had exposed him, time to set him down for 90 days, saying that we should never talk against the president of the United States, you know, or something like this. But as the 90 days were going on, certain incidents happened, and a brother named Benjamin, who I worked very closely with, was one of the imams at Mosque Number 7. And actually, before the assassination date, Benjamin had to jump in front of Malcolm a couple of times because there was a couple of scuffles within the mosque itself where certain brothers through the Fruit of Islam and stuff had possibly been told to begin taking a hit on Malcolm. But also, days before, the 2 or 3 weeks before the assassination, the police were up on top of
You mean
the
talking
buildings.
About a Kennedy?
No,
Malcolm. Okay.
We're up on top of these buildings in Harlem, you know, with rifles and stuff. They knew that something was going on, a hit was going to take. We found out later through this film we're doing that there was a dry run on the assassination of Malcolm X by the New York Police Department. And one of the black officers who went undercover and infiltrated the Organization of Afro-American Unity eventually brought that to our attention.
Wow. You know, one of the interesting things about that assassination is people don't remember that right across the street from the Audubon Ballroom is the New York Presbyterian Hospital. I know because I was born there, you know, and so when I went there, I always saw the Audubon. We knew what the Audubon was about. But it took 45 minutes to get across the street.
The brothers, a couple of brothers, went over there and got the gurney or whatever it is to come back in and get Malcolm's body, and they took him over to emergency. The police, the hospital personnel didn't do it. And he'd been, you know, shot something like 19 times, and they opened him up and whatever else, but by that time, he's already dead. But you know, the police or somebody had to warn everybody, and when you think about the conspiracy, they told the hospital, don't move. That had to be. I'm just saying, I think we're going to find it out more and more. And, you know, we've got some CBS Films footage to show when they arrested two of the people that were shooters, but we've got information now that lets us know that this one of the shooters, one of the three shooters, was an undercover policeman and who passed his gun to somebody else, and we know this other black officer.
Prior to the assassination, obviously Malcolm knew that something was in the works himself.
He told me. I traveled with him to Rochester 4 days before he was assassinated. He told me on the plane, he said, Brother Eugene, I'm a dead man. I'm going. He told me that he knew that a hit had been put out on his life by the Hunt brothers, who, as I told you earlier, owned rights to silver mines in the United States and had a conservative radio station. History also suggests that the Hunt brothers were responsible for killing John F. Kennedy.
Wow. He also, but before that, he had a relationship with Martin Luther King. Can you talk a little bit about that, the conversations and kind of what you all have found over the years? Definitely the FBI was aware of that and was concerned.
Coming to the end, after Malcolm went to Madagascar and was the other place of the Hajj?
Saudi Arabia? No, not Saudi Arabia.
It starts with the M.
Mali?
My mind is slipping a little bit now. But
Mecca. When he went to Mecca.
Yeah. He stayed in a tent with a white Muslim. And that's when he began to discover that much of what Elijah Muhammad had been teaching him to preach was a lie. He said he got along very well, this guy, explained to him all about the history of Islam or whatever else. When Malcolm came back off that Hajj, he immediately went to see a psychologist. He told me, he said, Brother, I've been preaching a lie all this time. You know, this is all during the time that he's been set down, and he's now going through these changes. He also began traveling more. He met with Nehru and other heads of African states and things, and begins discussing the hegemony of the United States, its role in worldwide imperialism and colonialism. And the African brothers begin to look and recognize what Malcolm was saying is the reason why all of them were in the same predicament, condition. So Malcolm used to spend a lot of time at the United Nations with these guys, you know, talking. And as Martin Luther King began to recognize more of the international scene, they started exchanging phone calls. Now, the police were at wiretap Malcolm's Teresa Hotel office. So they have a lot of these wiretaps. And that's only how we have discovered that this relationship was building between Martin and Malcolm. It's going to be a part of this documentary. But one of the things, after a big meeting that took place at Sidney Poitier's house that was hosted by Juanita Poitier, his first wife, Ossie Davis, Ruby Dee, A. Philip Randolph, Malcolm was at this meeting. They called Martin on phone because he was in jail in Florida from demonstrating again. Clarence Jones was at the meeting, so he got him.
The lawyer, Clarence Jones.
Right, his lawyer, yes. So Juanita and Ossie Davis had said to Malcolm, you got to move away from violence. Ossie Davis had offered to give Malcolm a big piece of money. Malcolm would accept it because Malcolm died broke. But he said, no, but I'm going to move to it. I want to be a part of the civil rights movement. So Juanita and them had talked and said, well, brother, with all this information you got, you ought to go before the United Nations and make this report. And he had agreed to do it. And Martin, through one of their discussions, said, well, when you make the report against the United States, colonialism, imperialism, hegemony, I'll be there to second it. It was a few days later that they intercepted a call from J. Edgar Hoover's office saying, this Malcolm X is the most dangerous black man in the world.
Wow. You know, and it makes you think, what would have happened if they were able to actually carry that out?
That's what we're getting at. Can you imagine? This country would have been all the better for it. We wouldn't have been the biggest imperialists in the world right now. We got the biggest military budget ever in the history of the world, even under Obama, you know, right now, and continue using drones and everything else. I mean, the world would have been much better off.
You know, with Malcolm, and one of the things we were talking about, he's a jazz aficionado.
Oh, yeah.
We know that Dr. King is into music.
Right.
Mahalia, that's right, Coretta's a singer, but Mahalia Jackson
right.
routinely would sing to him before he went to rallies and stuff.
Right.
The role that cultural expression, because I think that gets left out of the conversation, but it's something that the FBI obviously was paying attention to. With Malcolm, culture, music, dance, and all that, how does that kind of play out in terms of how he's able to disseminate his message, navigate with people, be heard, be seen? And, you know, your thoughts on just your observation as to how potent cultural expression was around, you know, this individual.
Yeah, it was somewhat divided because, remember, Malcolm came up in the streets. He played the joints and this and that. He loved jazz, you know, this and that. When he became an extreme Muslim, he said, we ain't got no business, you know, singing and this and that and blah, 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 for freedom. We've got to organize. But he really loved jazz. He didn't suggest that you could just sing your way to freedom, you know, and all this kinds of stuff. But the absolute love of music, he loved. I mean, he had a great relationship with the likes of Max Roach. Max Roach is a beautiful, positive, Dizzy Gillespie and some of them, you know, in this and that. So he understood the cultural perspective and what role it played, you know. And but it had to come from us. It didn't have to come, the words and stuff, from somebody else suggesting this is what you should say. These are the circumstances under which you should say it, and this and that. And so he grew more and more and more to that, and he began to recognize that violence was not the way. When he, as he and Martin became closer and closer together, but he said, violence is not the way. How can we talk about nonviolence and this and that, and we're bombing every country in the world, Vietnam, et cetera, whatever else. And of course, you know, the black leadership did not want him to talk about that, because when Johnson passed the Voting Rights Act, you know, they didn't want Martin to say anything against the Vietnam War. And they all great grew to hate him, and as you said earlier, because the government was giving them a little piece of chump change to run governments and that did nothing but perpetuate the status quo.
It's interesting, yes. You know, Malcolm dies broke, loved around the world, but he had enemies internally. And then Martin, of course, not liked by that civil rights movement that he helps to crystallize. I remember Jeremiah Wright talking about that.
Let me tell you one little story we learned about Martin, though. As I told you, nonviolence became a tactic. But I remember an incident where a brother, and I can't think of his name now, I got to know very well in Boston, was a newspaper reporter. When he came back from 10 years in Asia, he went to Martin's home to interview him. And they ushered him, and he sat down, something, he jumped up, and he looked down, it was a pistol. And Abernathy and them started laughing, said, well, you know, Martin got about 35 pistols around here. I mean, we practice nonviolence, but we got to be real.
That's funny. And I mean, we've all, you know, we kind of speculated that that was definitely the case.
Right.
You know, as we close out, Gus Newport, what lessons do you think should be learned? And I know you all are working on this documentary. What do you really want to make sure a younger generation gets out of Malcolm? I mean, his internationalism, his commitment to the movement. You know, some have speculated that if he was alive today, he would have been hanging tough with Obama. And others are saying, hell no, he would have been challenging him to the very end. But you know, how do you see it? And what do you really want people to take away?
Well, I think what we've come to recognize is that when that saying, the truth will make you free, history has to be recorded. And it has to be shown the role that certain groups and organizations and people played to correct that. And don't be practicing one thing and telling us this is democracy and doing something else so we can expose you and be able to challenge that. Because, you know, right now, COINTELPRO, stuff that's practiced the FBI, this and that, this is all used the fact that the major media is controlled by corporate America, et cetera, and all this thing. Who are the victims? As I say, this goes back to Occupy's 1% versus 99% and all that. All that stuff needs to be exposed as a method of education.
That's real talk. We've been talking with Gus Newport. We will be on the lookout. Want to thank you for taking time out this afternoon here on Hard Knock Radio. Malcolm X, a little bit of history. Marcus Garvey, Martin Luther King, it's always good to have a little bit of that insight. We're going to take a break on Hard Knock. We'll be right back.
There's no revolution. Revolution is based on land. Land is the basis of all independence. Land is the basis of freedom, justice, and equality. The white man knows what a revolution is. He knows that the black revolution is worldwide in scope and in reach. The black revolution is sweeping east, sweeping out. It's rearing its head in Latin America. The Cuban revolution, that's a revolution. They overturned the system. Revolution is in Asia. Revolution is in Africa. And the white man is screaming because he sees revolution in Latin America. How do you think he'll react to you when you learn what a real revolution is? You don't know what a revolution is. If you did, you wouldn't lose your peace. A revolution is bloody. Revolution is hostile. Revolution knows no compromise. Revolution overturns and destroys everything that gets in its way. You sitting around here like a knot on the wall, saying I'm gonna love these folks no matter how much they hate me. No, you need a revolution. Who ever heard of a revolution?
Yeah.
Where they lock on, as Reverend Klieg was pointing out beautifully, singing, we shall overcome. Just tell me you don't do that in a revolution. You don't do any singing, you're too busy swinging. It's based on land. A revolutionary wants land so he can set up his own nation. An independent nation. These Negroes aren't asking for no nation. They're trying to crawl back on the plantation. When you want a nation, that's called nationalism.
dark and the nights are cold. People acting like they lost their soul. And everywhere I go, I see another person like me trying to make it all feel like home. Feel like home. These days are dark and the nights are cold. People acting like they lost their soul. And everywhere I go, I see another person like me trying to make it all feel like home.
Standing on whites can help us, but they can't join us. They can. There can be no black-white unity until there is first a black unity. We cannot think of being acceptable to others until we have first proven acceptable to ourselves. Concerning nonviolence, it is criminal to teach a man not to defend himself when he is the constant victim of brutal attacks. There are problems in the community. Some of the examples of those problems are the vices that destroy the moral fiber in our community. Drunkenness, drug addiction, prostitution, organized crime that robs the Negro community of probably 90% of its economic potential and moral potential. One of my reasons for going out on a limb, as I have, is to try and make white people be shocked awake to some of their senses, because if they don't awake, they're going to find out that this little Negro that they thought was passive has become a roaring, uncontrollable lion right at their doorstep, not at their doorstep, inside their house, in their bed, in their kitchen, in their attic, in their basement. And if you know that in time, you can do something about it.
What do you think of Malcolm X's death?
I know it was no accident.
Who do you believe is responsible for Malcolm X's
death? The white power structure in America is behind it. They're quick to capitalize on by saying that one of his own kind did it, but they put it up to be done.
What do you mean, the white power structure?
The white power structure of America. They know they had more to gain by getting Malcolm X out of the way than they had to buy and let him live. That's why I say.
But what is the white power structure?
Never mind. I didn't say the white power structure. You know the white race, don't you?
In the last year, like Roy Wooker said, he changed. He wanted to get along with the white people. But you people didn't want to get along with us.
What does Malcolm X's death mean to you? What do you feel about it?
What do you feel about it?
What do you feel about it?
It's a blow to every black people in the United States of America. Black!
It's what?
It's a blow, he said.
It's a blow.
He says a blow to every black American, black people in the United States. That's what he was saying.
Why did it blow to you?
Because he's a part of me. Because he looks like me. And his skin is me. He's a black man and I'm a black man. And he takes up a black man's position. That's right.
He's a hero. I mean, he stood out among all black people. Why
does
the white man wear with that? Why was he a hero?
Respect.
Why was he off it in Princeton and all these big white universities? Because they respected him too, the way I respected him.
That's
he meant something to me. That's why I'm down here.
That's right. Well, they killed Malcolm X. Well, they hadn't like killing him. He was
that
man.
He was
for him.
Right.
If you kill him, you're going to be more killing going on.
That's right.
And you're saying that you believe this was paid for by whites?
Yes, by white people. Because what would it benefit? What would it benefit one of us to kill him? It wouldn't benefit nothing. Wouldn't benefit us anything at all. Just a white power structure in this country. Anytime a black man in this country stands up for his constitutional rights, he dies. What did Malcolm X mean to you?
He meant a great deal to me and my people. And sorry that a good man is gone. At the first idea of it, I couldn't have cried anymore, I don't believe, if I had lost my mother.
What did he mean to you? Can you tell me the power back?
He meant deliverance for my people. And I hope we all walk in the same footsteps as Malcolm X was walking.
Here. At this final hour, in this quiet place, Harlem has come to bid farewell to one of its brightest hopes, extinguished now and gone from us forever. For Harlem is where he worked and where he struggled and fought. His home of homes, where his heart was and where his people are. And it is therefore most fitting that we meet once again in Harlem to share these last moments with him. For Harlem has ever been gracious to those who have loved her, have fought for her, and have defended her honor even to the death. It is not in the memory of man that this beleaguered, unfortunate, but nonetheless proud community has found a braver, more gallant young champion than this Afro-American who lies before us, unconquered still. Many will ask what Harlem finds to honor in this stormy, controversial, and bold young captain, and we will smile, and we will answer and say unto them, did you ever talk to Brother Malcolm? Did he ever touch you? Did you have him smile at you? Did you ever really listen to him? Did he ever do a mean thing? Was he ever himself associated with violence or any public disturbance? For if you did, you would know him. And if you knew him, you would know why we must honor him. Malcolm was our manhood, our living black manhood. That was his meaning to his people. And in honoring him, we honor the best in ourselves. And we will know him then for what he was and is. A prince, our black shining prince, who didn't hesitate to die because he loved us so.
To be respected as a human being, to be given the right of a human being in this society, on this earth, in this day, which we intend to bring into existence by any means necessary.
Everywhere I go, I see another person like me trying to make it all feel like home. Standing on the...
Chairman, who's one of my brothers, ladies and gentlemen, brothers and sisters, I'm very honored, I feel very honored, it's an honor to me to be able to come back to the Militant Labor Forum again this evening. It's my third time here. I was just telling my brother up here that probably tomorrow morning the press will try and make it appear that this little chat that we're having here this evening took place in Beijing or someplace else. They have a tendency to discolor things in that way to try and make people not place the proper importance upon what they hear, especially when they're hearing it nowadays from persons whom they can't control, or, as my brother has just pointed out, persons whom they consider irresponsible. But it's the third time that I've had an opportunity to be a guest on the Militant Labor Forum, and I always feel that it is an honor. And every time they open the door for me to do so, I will be right here. The Militant newspaper is one of the best in New York City. In fact, it's one of the best everywhere you go today, because everywhere I go, I see it. I saw it even in Paris about a month ago. They were reading it over there, and I saw copies of it in some parts of Africa where I was during the summer. I don't know how it gets there, but if you put the right things in it, what you put in it, we'll see that it gets around. Tonight, during the few moments that we have, we're going to have a little chat, like brothers and sisters and friends and probably enemies too, about the prospect for peace or prospect for freedom in 1965. But you notice I almost slipped there and said peace. Actually, you can't separate peace from freedom. No one can be at peace unless he has his freedom. You can't separate the two. And this is the thing that makes 1965 so explosive and so dangerous. The people in this country who in the past have been at peace and been peaceful were that way only because they didn't know what freedom was. They let somebody else define it for them. But today, 1965, you find those who have not had freedom and not in a position to define freedom, they're beginning to define it for themselves now. And as they get in a position intellectually to define freedom for themselves, they see that they don't have it. And it makes them less peaceful or less inclined toward peace. So in discussing this topic tonight, Prospects for Freedom, in 1965, I think we have to go back at least 12 years or 10 years to the time when the struggle of the black man in America began to be projected into the limelight, not only in this country, but throughout the world. It started primarily with the Supreme Court decision, so-called desegregation decision, and I should say so-called desegregation, so-called decision, because there has been some doubt as to what they really handed down. One of the main ingredients in the struggle of the black man in America for the past 12 years has been the black Muslim movement. No one can deny the role that the black Muslim movement has played in America during the past 12 years, has been one of the main ingredients in the stepped-up militancy on the part of black people throughout this country. No matter what direction the black Muslim movement itself was headed in, no matter what its own organizational philosophy was, and no matter what other people thought about it, no matter what their personal opinions were of the black Muslim movement, still it cannot be denied that that movement, because of its uncompromising stand and uncompromisingly militant approach to things, forced other civil rights organizations to be more militant than they normally would have been, and forced many of the civil rights leaders definitely to be more militant than they ever would have thought of being. So the militancy of the black man in America during the past 10 years, in my opinion, can be traced largely to the existence and presence of the movement, which I'm referring to now, for purpose of identification, as the black Muslim movement. Its contribution to the black struggle for freedom in this country was militancy. It made many of our people dare to get loud for the first time in 400 years. It made many of the black leaders of the civil rights movement dare to get loud for the first time. I mean really loud for the first time in nearly 400 years. Of our being in this country. They got more militant than they intended to be, and they made many of the people become more militant than they intended for the people to be. It had a chain reaction effect that actually got out of control somewhat, because the leaders themselves never intended and never do intend for our people to go too far. Their primary purpose in our midst has always been to contain our struggle, not lead our struggle. Proof of which, seldom are they seen until the irresponsible elements in the black community begin to explode. And then they go all the way around the country to grab one of them from wherever he's traveling and bring him in to cool things down, to tell us to be cool, or tell us to take it easy, don't rock the boat. This is their function, this is their role. At least it has been up until recent times. They never have been put in the role that they're in with the intention, by the one who puts them there, of them leading us into any uncompromising and militant struggle. But the existence of some of the Muslim groups and the black nationalist groups that couldn't be controlled by the power structure downtown, and I only use the expression power structure downtown to keep from calling it what it actually is. These nationalist elements actually serve their purpose in that sense. They gave respectability to the civil rights group and gave acceptability to the civil rights group. 10 years ago or more, the NAACP was looked upon as a radical, leftist, almost subversive movement. And then when the black Muslim movement came along, the power structure said, thank the Lord for Roy Wilkins and the NAACP. true. Pick up any newspaper that was printed 10 years ago and read what was being said about CORE and NAACP and Urban League and some of these other groups. They were considered irresponsible. They were considered moving too fast. They were considered almost extremists. And then when they looked around one day and found someone talking about all of them are devils, they were all night looking up Roy Wilkins and James Farmer and the Right Reverend Dr. King and some of the others to soothe them and keep them thinking that all of our people didn't think like that. So it did contribute its part in the struggle. It made Roy Wilkins acceptable and honorable and responsible. And sometimes today I think he's forgotten what we've done for him. One of the things I noticed when I was in Africa traveling around, I noticed many Africans who were still colonized, still exploited, still oppressed. And one of the things all of them had in common was they seemed sad. They would discuss their sad plight, but they weren't ready to really do anything to change it. They seemed to be waiting on some miracle. But the contrasting difference between them and what happened in Kenya, the Kikuyu got mad. They just didn't care what the consequences were. They knew they cared nothing about legality, morality, or anything. All they knew was that they were being oppressed unjustly, illegally, immorally. And because of this unjust, illegal, immoral oppression that they were suffering, they came to the conclusion that they would be within their rights to bring it to a halt by any means necessary. And they adopted those means. When they began to use these means in their struggle for freedom, the press of the West began to project them in a very negative image. They were freedom fighters. They were African patriots fighting against oppression. They weren't fighting against a legal government. They weren't fighting against a moral society. They were fighting against a colonial power, an imperialist power, a vulturist society. And this vulturist society, with its control of the press and its allies here in the United States, who also control much of the press, projected these freedom fighters, these African patriots, in the image of savages, cannibals, terrorists, some as criminals, actually. And they projected Jomo Kenyatta in an image worse than all. But the Mau Mau weren't image conscious. They weren't status seekers. They weren't social climbers. They wanted freedom. And they came to a conclusion at a point in their journey that the only way there was to get it was the way they did it, and they got it. I admire them for that. I respect them for that. Now that they are free, Jomo Kenyatta, whose image was that of a monster 4 years ago, is the president of Kenya. He's respected. So much so that when the hostages were being held in Stanleyville and no one else dared to do anything about it, they called on Jomo and asked him would he sit down and mediate between the American ambassador, Atwood, there in Kenya, and Tom Kanza from Stanleyville, the same man that the West had projected as a monster. They had to call on him. And when you go to Kenya today, you will find white people in Kenya praying that Kenyatta doesn't die. The same, yes, they're praying, and they should. They are praying that he doesn't die. The same man that a few years ago was projected as a monster, as an extremist, as being irresponsible. Now they say he's the most responsible head of state on the African continent. So the difference between being projected as an extremist or a monster is only depends upon who controls the projection. If you project your own image, then you are able to project the positive image. But when your enemy is your master, and when your enemy masters the press that's going to build, create this image and project it abroad, then naturally your enemy is going to project you in the image of a monster. So I say, and I must say, because a reporter was asking me a few moments ago to either confirm or deny the statement that the Times had mentioned where I said we need a Mau Mau in the United States. I never would deny that. Why, we need more than a Mau Mau in the United States. I mean, actually, a person have a lot of nerve to ask me that. In a society, I'm deviating now because he put me off the track. I got to deviate. In a society where in 1964, three civil rights workers can be murdered in cold blood, and not the Mississippi government, the federal government can't do anything about it, I say we need a Mau Mau.
Putting the same spirit in the black people in the West.
Great, sound like the end of the world all over again, man. Six to five unawakened people, I promise you. Want to know who's going to take the responsibility.
And we will not rest until that place has been secured.
Say it, say it.
And we will not rest until that place has been secured.
We want an immediate end to the police brutality and violence against the so-called Negroes throughout the United States.
Too much to do.
Brothers and sisters, and friends, and I see some enemies.
We all agree tonight, all of the speakers have agreed, that America has a very serious problem. Not only does America have a very serious problem, but our people have a very serious problem. America's problem is us. We're her problem. The only reason she has a problem is she doesn't want us here. And every time you look at yourself, be you black, brown, red, or yellow, a so-called Negro, you represent a person who poses such a serious problem for America because you're not one.
This is John Trudell suggesting that you listen to and support KBOO Radio, 90.7 FM. Because we live in a time when the corporate state empire is doing more and more to reduce the voice of the people and the people's access to information and knowledge over the airwaves. It's very important to our present, to our future, that we have access to a clear way to speak out to the communities. Support community radio. KBOO Community Radio, 90.7 FM. Thank you.
This is Bird Note. Throughout most of the Americas, great horned owls are the preeminent predatory bird of the night. And they are ferocious. Their prowess as hunters depends on acute senses and stealth, but their feet and long curved talons secure the attack. The outermost of their four toes has evolved to rotate forward or backward for handling squirming prey, an advantage that most other birds of prey lack. These feet let the owls capture mammals as large as hares and raccoons. The grip strength in those feet, 200 to 500 pounds per square inch, is equal to that of a much larger bald eagle and up to 6 times stronger than the handshake of a bodybuilder. Talk about a death grip. And these owls definitely don't skip leg day. With strong, thick legs, great horned owls are power lifters. A 4-pound owl can take flight with up to 6 pounds of prey. Their preferred hunting tactic is to perch in a tree on the edge of an open field, listen closely, then drop, flap, and glide silently toward an unwary animal. And from there, those amazing feet take over. For Bird Note, I'm Mary McCann.
And you're listening to KBOO Portland 90.7.
Tune in to KBOO on Tuesday, February 24th at 10 a.m. for a special remembrance of Oregon State.